Hi, everybody. Alan Arnett here with another podcast on the blog on alanarnett.com. It is Monday, February the 19th, 2024, and I have got one of my favorite regular guests, Garrett Madison. Hello, Garrett.
Hello.
How are you doing? Where are you today?
I am in Mexico, Baja, California.
Half the time, I don't know where you are. One time I was talking to you, you're in Hawaii. I've talked to you from K2 Base Camp, Everest Base Camp. I think the last time we talked, you were down in Puntas Arenas, getting ready to go to Vinson. So, I mean, you're like, you are a Renaissance man.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, I guess that's a compliment. Hey, before we get into things today, because we have a lot to talk about, you just did something amazing on Aconcagua that we're going to get into. And then, of course, the Everest season is coming up. And there's been some recent changes that Nepal has enacted, like requiring wag bags, and they seem to be trying to limit the amount of luxury at base camp and use of helicopters. So lots of things going on there. I'd love to get your insight on. But before we do that, we often jump right into it without talking a little bit more about Garrett Madison and who is Garrett Madison and who is Madison Mountaineering. So first off, where were you born?
So I was born in Bremerton, Washington, near Seattle.
Outside of Seattle, yeah. And I remember talking to you as we were trekking in to go do K2, that you talked about you and your father were very close and you guys would do a lot of fishing together.
Yeah, we did a lot of fishing, and also we would go on backpacking trips in the summer into the Olympic and Cascade Mountains to try to hike up to some high alpine lakes to fish for trout, and that's what first introduced me to the mountains.
Do you think that's where the seed was planted?
Just planning a 5 or 6 day outing, and all the equipment, the gear, clothing, food to bring along for the week in the wilderness, and then having to carry it all on our backs. And trudge uphill into the mountains. That's where I got the bug.
And where did you actually then begin your kind of apprenticeship to become a professional mountain guide? Tell us how that started.
Yeah, so I actually started 25 years ago as an apprentice guide for Rainier Mountaineering.
Who didn't?
Yeah, totally. And I thought it was just the best job in the world. It was a summertime job for me when I was in college. But I just absolutely loved working up there, getting to know the other guides and all the climbers, and spending the summer on Mount Rainier.
Yeah. How many times have you summited Rainier?
Over 200 now.
It's so interesting. So many American guides began with RMI and on Rainier, and I guess now AAI and IMG and all the rest of the three-letter acronyms. So then you became a professional mountain guide. And who was that with? And tell us about that part of your chapter.
Yeah. So I worked for RMI for 8 summer seasons, and then I went to work for Alpine Ascents back in 2007, March, and became the guide manager and expedition leader. So I would help hire and train the mountain guides and plan out the season on Mount Rainier, and then Aconcagua, Mount Vinson, Mount Everest. And I got to lead a lot of those expeditions as well. So for me, it was a dream job to get to go to all these places and basically climb year round.
And so you were really the lead guide for AAI for a number of years, right?
Yeah. I was very fortunate to be leading a lot of the big expeditions like Everest and Aconcagua, Vinson, and a few Rainier trips here and there. So it was just a wonderful experience for me. Met a lot of incredible people.
And then you decided to go off on your own, created Madison Mountaineering.
Yeah, 10 years ago, next month is my my anniversary for Madison Mountaineering when I left Alpine Ascents and went off on my own. So looking forward to celebrating the 10-year anniversary, heading off to Everest here soon.
So was that a hard decision, or more importantly, the business side of that? Was that a risky decision? Because, you kind of had a good gig going with AAI.
Yeah, it was. It was tough for me because I felt like I had the best job of any mountain guide in the United States.
Yeah, and with one of the best companies.
Yeah, it was great. But I really wanted to do more. And I wanted to own the entire program. I felt like I was doing a lot of work to plan and lead the Everest expedition, for instance. But at the end of the day, if it went really well, I got a little bit of credit, and the company seemed to get the majority of credit. And that's how it works generally.
Yeah,
right. I thought, gosh, you know, I really enjoy this. I love it. I want to do more of it. But I want to own more of it. I want to have more reciprocation if things go well on the expedition.
Yeah. So Madison Mountaineering, you know, you've become one of the major guides globally. You're up there with the, you know, the legends of adventure consultants now, and Russell Bryce when he ran Himalayan Experience Himex, and of course International Mountain Guides and AAI. And now Madison Mountaineering is, in, at least in my mind, is right there in that same tier of high quality world class guides. How would you characterize what attracts people to climb with you, other than the fact that you are, that Garrett Madison has put more people on the summit of Mount Everest than any other Western guide, not Sherpa, but any other Western guide. And how many people has that been at this point?
Oh, we're up into the 80s now.
And you're probably also the leader on K2. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's probably what, 15 or 20 or?
Yeah, about 20. Yeah.
Yeah. Something like that. So what do you think attracts people to your company? Because one of the things that you do is that you are not the cheapest. I mean, right. you are not the Spirit airline of the guiding industry.
Well, thank you very much for your kind words and your generosity to put me in a league with some of those companies and guides you referenced. That means a lot. And gosh, I'm really happy to hear you say that. I think for me personally, I love going into the mountains. And yeah. I love going on expeditions. I love climbing, and I enjoy doing it with other similar like-minded people that really enjoy the experience and want to plan ahead and prepare and train and do it in the right way, whatever that means to us as individuals. And I think I've got a pretty relaxed vibe, pretty mellow mentality. Yeah. I don't get too hyped up about stuff or too emotional generally. And it does cost more to join one of our trips. But part of the reason for that is quality over quantity. Try to work with really good, experienced mountain guides and friends in the industry, whether it's Western guides or Nepal Sherpas or guides in Argentina, Ecuador, and just keep it high quality throughout. And because as an owner operator, I still enjoy going on the trips, I want to make it as enjoyable as possible, as fun as possible, and just have a great experience start to finish. So focusing on the little things, and then also just overall leadership and management to me is really important.
Yeah. You are also one of the rare owner operators that actually climbs. I mean, there's two different models. There's nothing wrong with them, but some people choose to stay in base camp. I mean, Russell Bryce was famous, you know, for having his, you know, sitting on the radio and making his notes and tracking everybody. And, you know, of course, a lot of documentaries on that. But you actually are boots on the mountain. You actually climb with your clients on most of the climbs, not all of them these days, but most of them.
Yeah, I still enjoy it. I still want to be up there with everybody and share in those magical moments. And if we're lucky to get to the summit, be up there to high five people and be part of that magical experience for them. And I feel like I can still add meaningful value being up there as a mountain guide, a decision maker, a leader, and provide assistance when needed. But as soon as I feel like I'm too old to add value, then I'll stay in base camp.
Yeah. Well, as people often ask me now, you know, Alan, are you going to go climb another mountain? I say, you know, there's old climbers and bold climbers, but not old climbers.
Right. Exactly. You got to know when to say when up there.
Yeah. You got to, as Clint Eastwood would say, a man's got to know his limitations. So, yeah. In fact, you just got back from Antarctica, and I think you told me that was your 25th.
I got my 25th, 26th, and 27th summits of Mount Vinson. Did three trips back to back to back. Had a wonderful season. Had a great colleague with me, Benny, co-guiding, and had wonderful climbers. We lucked out with good weather on our summit days. So just an awesome season all around in Antarctica.
And none of those storied long week delay trying to get in or out?
No, we got really lucky with the aircraft logistics. ALE did a fantastic job, of course, with all the flights in and out. And we did have some bad weather, but it happened between the climbs.
Great.
So we were lucky up high. You know, we just spent a couple of days on high camp, got some beautiful summit days, and got out of there.
And they're using now a 757 instead of the Ilyushin. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, they're using a Boeing 757 to fly people in and out of Antarctica, which is really comfortable and efficient. So it works well.
I hear it's all business class, the entire airplane, right?
Yeah.
But you know, you got to miss those days in that Russian, cargo craft.
Yeah. You can't replace that experience, like being inside the fuselage of this big military transport plane and seeing all the wires hanging out and cargo packed behind. And yeah, those made some good stories.
And that grisly Russian crew, and and you look
yeah.
behind you, and you never knew what was going to be behind you. That cargo back there,
right,
could be a snow machine or a pile of toilets or whatever. So,
right.
So you after you did Antarctica, then let's shift over and talk about your Aconcagua. I don't even know what word to use to describe it. I'm going to use the word ambush. Because the way you did it, it was kind of like a SEAL Team 6 ambushing the mountain. So I don't want to bury the lead, but you did something that's pretty rare in climbing Aconcagua in like Mendoza to the summit to Mendoza in like one night. So
exactly.
Let's break it down. So when you're finished, I'm going to ask you why. But
Well, there's a little backstory to it. So Jeff Arnold, who was a climber on my last Mount Vincent expedition, a great guy from Canada, had already been planning to do Aconcagua after Mount Vincent, and he had registered with another company. And he went up there and unfortunately had food poisoning in Camp One. So came down, got back to Mendoza, and then contacted me and said, hey, would you like to go back and give it a shot with me? And I was planning to head home, actually. I'd been in Argentina to check in on some of our Aconcagua groups and logistics for the season, but wasn't planning to climb myself. And I said, I'd love to, but I'm not acclimatized, and it looks like there's a really good weather window next week. But the only way we could do this quickly would be to use helicopters to fly into Camp 2. To use these new oxygen systems that are prototypes, electronically controlled, computerized regulators that are not commercially available. So they're still in the test phase. But with the oxygen, the helicopters, I think we could pull off this quick ascent of the mountain and do it safely. And the weather looked amazing the next week for a couple of days, just perfect weather, no wind, warm temperatures, clear sky.
That's rare.
He said, let's do it. Let's go for it. So it was a bit of a high altitude science project. We met up with Kerry Kobler, a Swiss mountain guide who's based in Minnesota and works with one of the companies there on Aconcagua. He had the oxygen systems, which he's helping develop out of Germany. And he showed us how to use them. They'd only been tested a couple times before. And these new oxygen systems are on demand. So there's a nasal cannula we wear. And when we inhale through our nose, the sensor releases a puff of oxygen. So it's not like the constant flow rates of the systems we're using now in Nepal. It's just a very efficient system. It releases air when you need it. So we had these oxygen systems with us. We tested them out in Mendoza, and then we got the helicopters arranged and the park permits arranged, and everybody was supporting us in this crazy mission, the logistics companies. And so it was great to have the support of everyone, but we didn't want to talk about it too much for fear that things might go sideways up there. So we left Mendoza in the morning, drove up to the park entrance, got on the helicopter, flew into base camp for a couple minutes, and then did a heli bump up to Camp 2 one by one, which is 18,250 feet. So not being acclimatized, once we got up there, I was taking altitude medication for safety prophylactically. And also we started using the oxygen systems just to see how we felt. And I could definitely feel my body reacting to the altitude. And spending the day there, resting, eating a couple of meals, taking it easy, I felt like I was acclimatizing as well. So we left that night, 3 a.m., climbed to the summit, had a beautiful day up there, got back to Camp 2, and the helicopter usually doesn't fly midday, just morning and evening. And we weren't sure if it was going to pick us up or not. So we walked out against them. And then the helicopter came and picked us up that evening at base camp, flew us to the trailhead. We drove back to Mendoza and had a nice celebration there. So it was only one night gone from Mendoza. Crazy. A lot of fun.
So was this a climb?
Well, I wouldn't so much call it a climb because we helicoptered into camp too and then helicoptered out of base camp. I might call it a helicopter assisted guided ascent to the top of the mountain to qualify what it was. But I wouldn't call it a climb. You know, guys like Carl Egloff or Tyler Andrews have run from the trailhead to the summit of Aconcagua and back in under 12 hours. So to me, truly superhuman, impressive accomplishments. And I would not compare this at all to what they did. A very different style of ambush approach to the mountain. But a lot of fun nonetheless.
Oh, man, that's crazy. That's crazy. Well, like, you know, I guess that we have rules to be broken. I'm not sure what Elizabeth Hawley would say about this. She'd probably just shake her head and go,
Right. But I think it was interesting to test out the new technology. I think these new oxygen regulators that electronically controlled will make their way to Nepal. We're going to try to test a couple on Everest this spring, see how they do. They're battery powered, so there's a lot more moving parts. But I think they could become very useful at 8,000 meters in the Himalayas.
So I assume they're much more efficient, so you can use a lower quantity of oxygen.
Exactly. Yeah. It's something like, you know, five or six or maybe eight times more efficient than current system. So it means a lot less oxygen bottles have to be carried up the mountain for climbers to use. So instead of like a climber needing 10 bottles on Everest, it might be just a couple of bottles they can use for their ascent.
That could be a game changer. I mean, both for, you know, ecologically and financially and risk of carrying the bottles through the ice fall or helicopters to get them up there. So that could really be a game changer. Isn't that pulse on demand use in some aircraft by some pilots?
I know it's also got some medical applications. So it's definitely a technology that's out there, but hasn't yet been adapted for high altitude climbing.
Do you know what the reason is? Is it reliability or?
Yeah, I think just having a battery powered system with a computer, you know, it has some bugs still in the system. And I had to pull the batteries out of mine and reset it a few times when it stopped working. So it's definitely not ready for commercial production. But the systems we use now at 8,000 meters, as you know, are no moving parts really. It's just a metal contraption that you adjust the flow rate on. So it's very sturdy, robust, and safe and low chance of failure.
Yeah, kind of brute force. Yeah. That's crazy. So you got to hit Control Alt Delete to reboot your oxygen. Right. Well, you mentioned this Everest coming up, so let's move into that. So what does your season look like? You're leaving, what is this, middle of February? So you're leaving when?
March, I head over to Nepal, and we've got kind of the standard program, Everest, Lhotse, and now Nupse. We got to the top of Nupse last season, did all three peaks, and so we've got a couple folks that want to climb Nupse as well this season, and then, of course, our folks that are doing Everest and some adding on the Lhotse climb option as well.
Nupse is it's kind of a different game than the other two because, you know, it's a smidge under 8,000 meters, but the very top, and you leave from Camp 2, right, in the Western Two.
Yes.
And going up that ridge line, first off, that's really rock fall prone, and the very summit is very corniced. So when you did it last year, I mean, a lot of people get to the bottom of that cornice, and they say, good enough, and they turn around. Were you guys able to navigate that cornice?
Yeah, we did. And the year before, we had attempted it, and we got up to the summit ridge and then realized the higher point of the ridge, the true summit, was about 50 or 100 yards away.
Whoops. And
it was already midday. We didn't have any anchors or rope really left over. And so we were happy with what we had accomplished, and we headed down. But this last season, when we went up, we knew where we needed to angle climbers left going up towards the top to get to where we could access the true summit. So we were happy to finally make it to the True Summit last season. And the climbers who were with me, they said it was harder than a K2 summit day or an Everest summit day for them. It's a long, steep day, a lot of altitude gain and tough terrain. So it's a worthy objective, I think.
And do you go directly from camp to the summit one push?
Well, do you stop somewhere? We have a high camp. We put our high camp in at the base of the arête. So we go from camp two on Everest up around towards the base of the Lhotse face and then keep going kind of under the Noopsee Ridge and work our way up higher to almost the elevation of camp three on the Lhotse face. And that's our high camp. And then we leave at like midnight to climb all the way up back to camp and then try to get back to camp two where we have more resources and support.
Hey, don't let me forget, but I want to ask if you're going to be doing another unclimbed peak in Nepal this year. But so you're going to Everest, you're going to do Everest and Lhotse and Noopsee. That's become Everest, Lhotse has become such a popular double.
Yeah.
You know, though, Garrett, I still, maybe I'm the old man, get off my lawn, but I still don't think summiting Lhotse from Everest from the South Col is cricket. I think you need to go back down.
All the way back up.
At least a camp two. I mean, you know, otherwise you're just kind of, you know, ridge hopping. But it's gotten incredibly popular. A lot of people do it now.
Huh? Yeah. Well, it's a nice view from the top of Lhotse looking back on Everest.
Gazing out and you're already there.
Yeah. Might as well do it.
So have you heard anything about the weather? Snow year? Do you think it's going to be a regular high-low?
Well, I don't really know. Our team right now is marking out our base camp location because we have to get there early to reserve that at Everest Base Camp. And then we'll start trekking in early April and see what the weather brings. But I'm hoping there's decent snowpack. I know it's been pretty stormy with precipitation and snowfall recently in the Khumbu. So more snow is always good, right? To fill in the crevasses and cover some of the icy slopes. So hopefully we'll have some good winter snow left over by the time we show up in spring.
So it'll be interesting to see how many people come this year. Last year was a near record, not near record summits, but near record was a record number of permits. And with the permit price for Everest going from $11,000 per person to $15,000 per person next year in 2025, my theory is that we're going to see a pretty good tick this year and people wanting to jump in before the prices go up.
Right. Yeah. I would think so. I remember last season on Everest was markedly colder until the very end of May. And I think that just made it more challenging overall for climbers. Just tougher, colder conditions, tougher to stay healthy. Some of the people summiting in mid-May came back and said, oh my gosh, Kenton Cool said the coldest summit he'd ever had up there. And some of the Sherpas who had, you know, 20 plus summits said the same thing. Oh my gosh, coldest summit day ever. One guide, even when he came down, said, if I had known how cold it was going to be, I wouldn't have gone.
Yeah, Guy Cotter told me that for the first time they've been going, obviously, since 92 or something, that for the first time, a couple of the Sherpas got some frost nip, and that's never happened last year.
Right. Yeah. Right. So. But then the temperature swung the other way. And when we summited May 24th, it was the warmest day I'd ever experienced. I was unzipping my suit, taking layers off. Yeah.
Really. You know, when we talk about climate change, I think this is one of the telltale signs is that the high variability in the weather now. Because remember, what was it 2 years ago that basically almost the entire month of May was a summit window, whereas in 2019, it was only 3 days were suitable for summits.
Right.
So, you know, yeah, you know, the weather, go figure. So, and I know you get a professional weather forecast on an almost daily basis, if not multiple times when you get ready to go up. So you're well prepared. Also, I find it interesting that you're one of the companies that tends to go towards the tail end of the season. Not, you know, you're not jumping behind the rope team to try to capture that first window.
Right. Yeah. I just find that there's so many people on the mountain who are impatient and want to go at the first opportunity. And that's okay, but I would rather wait a little bit and kind of let things clear out. And then go when it's not so crowded. So the last two seasons on Everest, we've had our summit day all to ourselves at the top for an hour or two at the summit. We were the only team up there. So that goes against everything people hear in the media these days of it being a line to the summit of climbers. So by waiting a little bit, strategizing and being patient, it's worked out really well for us. So I'll plan to keep waiting a little bit longer to go for that summit.
I often tell people that Everest is a big mountain. I mean, it's hard to comprehend how physically large it is. And you say, oh, there's 500 people going up. Well, you take 500 people, spread them over 2 weeks, and then, you know, you're going to have situations like you have where you're the only ones up there, which is, oh my gosh, I can't imagine. I think when I summited in 2011, we had 150 people summit the entire season.
Wow.
So, yeah. So it wasn't crowded at all for us. Wow. Hey, you know, so Nepal is issuing some new rules, kind of crazy with 6 weeks to go before the season, you know, starts that they're issuing all these new rules. But one of them, I find it to be positive, but I'm still skeptical. And that's the requiring the use of so-called WAG bags or plastic bags to remove solid human waste from the high parts in the mountain. So just so everybody understands, you know, solid waste has been a problem. Human waste, feces, has been a problem on mountains from the time mountains have been climbed. I can remember being on Elbrus and just seeing a horrible field of poop all over the place. The same thing above Camp 1 on Aconcagua, that was just horrible. But places like Denali, you know, they've done their best to try to manage it. They've made some mistakes, honestly, with letting guys throw the, solid waste into crevasses, thinking that it's going to get, you know, it's going to get ground up, but it ended up still getting into the groundwater. So they've changed that. Vincent is probably the gold standard in Antarctica for managing everything in terms of leave no trace. So, you know, I know that you're pleased that Nepal is going to do this. They bought supposedly 8,000 bags. And I don't know if you have to buy them or they're going to issue them for free. But every climber supposedly will have two. They can use them 4 to 6 times, which I'm a little skeptical about. And then they're expected to carry it back down. And we'll get into a couple of the hot spots in the mountain. But first off, what's your overall reaction to this new regulation?
I think it's very positive and much needed. And thankfully, things are now moving in this direction. We've been bringing WAG bags to Everest and other peaks in Nepal for a long time. And they're expensive. You know, they're even wholesale costs. They're like $3 a piece. You have to transport them. And then we have to carry them up. They don't weigh much, but then we use them and bring them down full and dispose of the waste properly. It takes a little bit of effort, right? And coordination, but it's so important, right? And if we're not doing this in the mountains, things will become polluted. So Rainier has been mandating the use of blue bags, a similar type bag system for, I don't know, 25, 30 years. And I talked to climbers who climbed before them, before my time, and they said, oh yeah, the route on Rainier used to be full of poop because people would just poop next to the trail up high. But ever since they changed the rule and mandated packing your human waste out, it's a very clean place. Of course, Antarctica is super clean because of the enforcements and the regulation. Aconcagua, about 20 years ago, the park there mandated the use of poop bags. And now it's incredibly clean compared to what it was probably when you were there. So I think it's been a long time coming, and I'm really happy to hear that Nepal is embracing this. I think it's a great step in a good direction, and hopefully it won't be needed as a regulation. Hopefully at some point, all climbers will recognize the importance of packing out their human waste in addition to their other garbage.
And I assume that this regulation, this rule applies to not only members, but also Sherpas.
I would assume so. Yeah. And, you know, what we've been doing like up at Camp 2 is we'll have a toilet tent with a sit down toilet seat and underneath that a bucket or a barrel lined with a plastic robust garbage sack. And then all the poop goes in there. And then we actually have one of our staff members carry it down to base camp and then dispose of it properly. So I think the WAG bags, the individual poop bags, are great for places like Camp 1 or Camp 3 or Camp 4, or if someone has to go on the route somewhere in the ice fall or on summit day, they can use this wag bag and then pack their human feces off the mountain. So I think it's just important to recognize that there's so much human traffic that we can't just go wherever we want up there. We have to make sure that we're packing it off the mountain some way.
And of course, the South Col is probably last time I was there was 13 years ago. You were there last year. I understand it's gotten pretty bad.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it has not just human waste, but also other types of garbage left behind. So hopefully, with some of these initiatives, all of the human impact will start to diminish on the mountain.
Well, I'm sure it won't go perfect this year because nothing does the first time. I was talking to a friend the other day about when Rainier first implemented it. And the first year they said was a disaster, that they ended up having this pile of little wag bags, that was the size of a house, down at Paradise. And people are saying, well, what are we going to do with it now? All you really did was shift the problem. They eventually figured that out. And that's something that people like Dan Mazur has been working on with this biogas project down by Gord Shep, because the way that the human waste at base camp anyway, there's, this poor guy comes and collects the blue barrels and they put them on their back or on a yak and take them back down to Gord Shep, and then they just pour it into a pit. And the theory is that it will disintegrate, but the problem is that it's low temperature, low oxygen, and there's a lack of microbes to be able to break down. Mm-hmm. So you've got to have some catalyst. Otherwise, all you're doing is moving one pile to another pile. And that's what this biogas, and supposedly it's going to come online next year in 2025.
Right.
Yeah. And so that's kind of the long-term solution to this problem. So I'm optimistic. I'll be fascinated to talk to you after this season and get your take on whether it worked or not. And again, what the adherence was, but good on Nepal. I'm always criticizing Nepal for not managing the mountain, but at least they're trying. Another thing that they're trying to do though, and this may be a little more touchy, is that they want to limit, they're citing climate change and the fragility of the Khumbu Icefall in the region, but they want to limit the footprint and the impact of teams at base camp. Mm-hmm. So one of the things they're targeting is so-called quote-unquote luxuries. So in recent years, it seemed like every team, whether it's Nepali or Austrian or American, has giant domes, multiple giant domes, for relaxation and for eating and dining. And then they've got not only private tents, but it used to be, the VE25 North Face, three-person tent. You had one of them, you felt like you were a king or queen. But now you've got these box tents, and you have, cots, and you're off the ground. And some people have a ensuite toilet, in other words, a little tent attached to that. So it's like a hotel room. And then others have bakeries, and others have massage tents. And it's kind of it's starting to get a little over the top, in my opinion. Now, that said, and then I'll shut up and get you to talk. But I think that is sort of like airplanes. If you've got, first class, business class, and coach, and everybody gets in at the same time, but your experience is totally different. And so the market supports that. And apparently the market in mountaineering for Everest also supports that, because these teams with these VIP services or high-end services, they typically sell out. Yeah. So there are people that are willing to pay for these luxuries. So Nepal, by trying to limit them, I understand the theory, but I don't, from a free market perspective, I don't know. So let's start with your high level thought on these regulations in the first place, not luxury per se, but what do you think about Nepal trying to tell you how to run your expedition?
It's going to be tough to interpret and enforce this one, because how do you define luxury? And some camps do have some very noticeable over the top seeming tents for individuals. But they're going to have to define what constitutes luxury and what doesn't. For instance, I think we have a very nice camp, but I'm not ready to go there where individual climbers have a gigantic dome tent just to themselves to sleep in and, you know, hang out. We have more communal style dining tents and communications tent, relaxation tent. So for me, my focus is still on climbing the mountain. And while I think it's important to have a comfortable and nice base camp, I'm not ready to go down the road of Everest Base Camp glamping. I want to keep my focus on the ascent and the climb to the summit and back. And we can do it all with a very nice base camp, but I don't need to go over the top in base camp and have all of these luxuries, champagne and caviar and whatnot. I'd rather keep it focused on the climb. So that's my personal choice. But I think for some teams identifying a new market available and a demand for some luxuries in base camp, that's great. I think it's fantastic. And Nepal will have to figure out how to define that and then how to tax it, essentially, like the mansion tax in Los Angeles. They decided, well, any house over a certain square footage should pay an extra tax. Okay, well, define exactly how you're going to do it, and then those people have to pay a little bit extra.
Yeah, one of the criticisms is that by coming out with this policy, again, with only 6 weeks, and, you know, as you've done this, you are doing this, you've already made investments, you've already spent cash on this upcoming season, and you've got staff and everything all set up. And so to kind of pull the rug out from underneath you at this late date, yeah, it seemed like they should have talked to the shareholders a little bit earlier, the stakeholders.
Right. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if some of these new regulations are enforced. I hope the wag bag is to bring human feces. And we'll plan to bring our own as well in case there's a shortage, because two for the whole season doesn't seem like enough to me.
Yeah, and reusing the same one multiple times. I know what's been called like kitty litter inside. Yeah. It's supposed to break it down or make it not smell. And honestly, I'm not sure I see the lawyer from Zurich who just paid $125,000 carrying his own poop down. I hope so. I hope so. I hope people get into the right spirit. Another change a lot of these rules though have been just recycled. I've got a chart that I use every year. I call it the silly rules, and it goes back to 2013. It's just, I've documented the new rules introduced every 3 years. It's basically the same grouping. But one of them is helicopters. And again, this year, they want to limit the use of helicopters. Last year, I've had people tell me that base camp is now, it looks like an airport with helicopters coming in every few minutes. Using helicopters to fly climbers to camp two and fly them off. And then they claim, you know, that they had a round trip summit. The use of helicopters seems like it's gotten a little bit out of control as well. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. The amount of helicopter traffic is hard for me to comprehend. I remember when we didn't see hardly any helicopters ever come to Everest back, you know, pre-2007 or 2008. They can be very useful for rescues, right? If someone has an injury or needs a medical evacuation, it's very useful to have a helicopter pick you up from base camp, or even camp one, camp two, and now even camp three. They can do the long line short haul. But if you're using it to bypass certain parts of the mountain, that brings some other questions up. And I think the helicopter traffic is just, it's a lot. So I think it's good that Nepal is looking more closely at that, and maybe they'll decide what's necessary and what's not necessary for people to do. And even the scenic flights to Mount Everest base camp, I think they've started to limit that somewhat, where before people could actually land at base camp, but now they're not allowed to land, which I think is a good thing. But it'll be interesting to see where things go. And also, as technology continues to develop, if the helicopters are able to pick people up even higher on the mountain, say South Col or the summit someday. Currently they can't do that, but that could happen in 10 or 20 years time.
Yeah. A lot of people talk about the ice fall being so dangerous. And so I remember talking to Russell Bryce years ago, and he made a prediction that one day both the ice fall and the Western Coombe will be unclimbable or impassable due to the melting and the large crevasses and just the instability. So hypothetical, using your crystal ball, do you think the ice fall is going to become unclimbable? And if so, do you think that helicopters, taking people using helicopters to get to camp too, is fair, reasonable, fair play?
Well, that's an interesting question. And again, it kind of goes back to what you want out of the experience as an individual. Like on my recent Aconcagua ambush, as we called it, we flew into camp too, because we didn't have the time to do a proper acclimatization and ascent of the mountain. So we thought, well, let's try to get to the top and see how we can do it with the helicopter, the oxygen, some other assistance. So if your aim on Everest is just to stand at the top, people could helicopter into camp two or conceivably camp three, maybe someday to camp four, and then walk to the top. What that means to them and the community is an entirely different discussion. But it's interesting. The ice fall on Everest has seemed to become easier, I would say, over the last 10 years. Perhaps the melting patterns are causing sections of the Khumbu ice fall to be less severe. So we'll see as it changes, as climate change continues to impact the mountain and the glaciers, if the ice fall becomes easier or harder. But there's usually, I don't know, not too many ladders the last 5 or 10 years, maybe just a half dozen ladder crossings or 10 at the most. Whereas when you were there, how many ladder crossings were there, like 40 or 50?
Yeah. I mean, it was huge.
Yeah. So it seems like it's become easier in recent years. But if people continue to use helicopters as they've been doing to get to camp two and then climb from there, that can shorten the climb. It could perhaps make it safer, but it becomes a different experience as well if you're not climbing to the...
Yeah, I believe it's Mark Batard tried to pioneer this this route that is to the climber's right up on the flanks of Noopsy, going along there. I think the Benegas brothers also investigated that at some time, and it's never really worked out. Do you think that'll ever become an option?
I don't think so. Looking at that that face on Noopse from base camp, it just looks treacherous. I don't think there's any easy way through there. So I'm glad they tried and you know, tried to make it work, but I don't think it's going to become a reality. I think the Khumbu ice fall will still be the main access road to get up and down the mountain. But I'm glad that helicopters are allowed in Nepal. I think it's, again, it's great for medical evacuations or rescues. I think on the north side, the Chinese Tibetan side, they're still not allowed. So if you get in trouble and need an evacuation, you have to be carried out on someone's back. Or if you get down to ABC, you could go out on a yak or a horse conceivably.
Yeah. And then at base camp, you can get driven back out. Right. Another thing that's been popping around is moving base camp, Everest base camp on the Nepal side, actually almost down to Gorge Shep, again, because of fear of contamination of the groundwater at the ice fall of the Khumbu Glacier. But that seems to be another one of these ideas floated and never got any traction.
Yeah, and I think the sanitation at Everest Base Camp, because it's so well regulated, with everybody going into toilets that are barrels catching the human waste and then getting packed out, I don't think there's a groundwater contamination issue at Everest Base Camp. Of course, there's people living there and, you know, food being consumed and whatnot, so there probably is some amount of contamination, but hopefully we can continue using base camp where it is. It's such a beautiful location, and it's nice to start the route there. If we had to base out of Gorakh Shep, that would add like an hour or two to the climb, just getting to the ice fall. So it's, as you know, it's such a pretty spot there. There's just nowhere in the world like it. Hopefully going there.
Absolutely. So as we wrap up here, I wanted to ask you about, you've been doing some first ascents in the last handful of years. So tell us, what's going on there and any plans?
Yeah. Oh, it's so much fun to identify an unclimbed peak and try to figure out a route to climb. This year, we've got one actually planned for the first time in Pakistan. So right alongside our K2 expedition, we're going to have a team going in to attempt what we think is an unclimbed peak. And we've got the route identified. We've got some photos of it. But I'm not telling people the name of the peak per se, because I've had the experience before where I put it out there and then somebody else got there and climbed it first before I was able to give it a try. So we're keeping it secret, but we've got a great team of climbers, and it should be a lot of fun. So fingers crossed it works out.
And, you know, speaking of the K2 area, I was thinking about this yesterday, that all the issues that we're seeing now on Everest, because K2 now is increasing in popularity, you know, it's just, it's become like a, you know, a baby Everest in terms of crowds and, you know, style and all of that. So it also follows that it's going to have the same problems with, you know, I know camp, people talked last year about Camp 2 just being really, you know, just Camp 1 and Camp 2, which is very small real estate, just stinking to high heaven. And I can't, I suspect base camp is going to have the same problems with solid human waste. And it's, you know, the proximity back to the nearest village is, you know, 3-day walk. And helicopters are really not used because of the conflict zone with Kashmir and India. So I think Pakistan has a huge issue, which is looming. And I'm not sure they're going to, you know, at the moment that they've internalized how big it is and how fast that train is coming towards them. I hope they're learning from Nepal.
Yeah, I hope so too. And they have taken some good steps. They used to burn all of the garbage in base camp, and now they pack it out. So that's a good step. And hopefully they'll follow with the wag bags and requiring teams to pack out their human feces. That would be a great step as well. Last year, they almost implemented a new rule banning the use of generators, of gasoline-powered generators. They said only solar. And of course, we said, oh my gosh, how are we going to charge our radios and satellite phones and other electronics? And so at the last minute, they didn't enforce it. They let us take our generator in so we could power up our camp when solar's not enough. Because if you have cloudy days, you're not recharging your batteries. Yeah. So for safety and for communication requirements, we do need enough power. And even at Everest Base Camp, you know, we've got lots of solar, but if you have a few cloudy days, you're not able to charge anything. So we have a couple of generators we can run if we have to, but trying to use solar as much as possible.
That's great. Well, my friend, I wish you the best of luck for another safe and successful season. I know you've got Tyree as your one of your lead guides now, who's doing a fantastic job. Also, there's another one that came in my mind, and then we'll wrap up. You've been kind of recruiting a who's who. Therese Sylvester is one of your lead guides, just a world-class individual. But you had Ed Beesters guiding on Aconcagua. You've had Conrad Anker. So, I mean, dude.
I just feel so so honored to get to work with guys like Ed, Conrad, Teray, even Cacho Beza from Argentina, who's got 58 summits of Aconcagua now. Just people who love the mountains and love mountain culture and really want to spend more time there with other like-minded individuals. So it's been so much fun to climb with Conrad a few times in Antarctica, hopefully a few more in the future. And same with Ed on Aconcagua and in Antarctica. And hopefully we'll have more opportunities to get out there. It's just so nice to get to hear the stories from these legends and hear about how they got to where they are in life. And they have so much knowledge and insight and love for the mountains. It's really great to be around them a bit.
I just had one of my summit coach clients, Ryan, who summited Aconcagua with Ed and under Madison Mountaineering. So, and he said climbing with Ed Beesters was a dream come true, just a true lifetime experience. And Ryan's going to be with you on Everest coming up here in a few weeks. So I love that. I love that approach. And these legends, I love them staying in the game and, you know, not retiring. And just it's just super all the way around. So.
Yeah, they have a lot to share. So hopefully they can stay in the game with us for a few more years and a few more climbers can get out there with them in the hills.
That's cool. All right, man. All right, Garrett, best of luck to you. And we will talk again, I'm sure.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Alan.
Namaste.